What is up? What is going on, everybody? This week, we are going to find out what is in the box, and we're going to do it on the other side of the song. Welcome back, everyone, to another new episode of The Threequel. As well, always, I am one of your three co-hosts, Ethan Klein. Here with me, Brad Miller, and seemingly now for the future, Mike Duranik. There was a chance he might have quit, depending on how this podcast started, but it seems like we are good to go. Gentlemen, how are you doing this evening?
Much better now, Ethan. I'm glad you got that correct. You did open that appropriately. Well done.
Yes, there was only one way to open this podcast, and so I'll renew my contract, such as it is, and we'll keep the good times rolling. I'm ready to talk this movie with you guys.
Oh, I am very ready to talk this movie. We are talking Seven this week, the Brad Pitt, Morgan Freeman, 1995 mystery thriller, I guess, if we want to call it that. I don't know what to call this thing. It is a whole mixed bag. We are going to get into all of it. Let's dive right in, guys. The question that I always ask, and I think this will be a pretty interesting answer, more so kind of once we start talking about the movie, some things maybe you recall from your first viewing, but what was your first experience with Seven? Much like last week, if you didn't see Tin Cup in theaters, there is no way you saw this one in theaters. But what was your first experience with Seven? What did you bring into this rewatch here for this week's episode?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure this was a rental for me. I don't have a recollection of the first time that I saw it. Surprisingly enough, I've only seen it three, four, five times maybe in all the years that it came out, which is surprising for how good it is. But I think that also goes to show just how dark this movie is, that it's not one that you're excited to put on and watch frequently.
Yeah, I'm sure it was on VHS, and it was probably from my brother's VHS collection, because there's no way that my parents would have had me renting this from Blockbuster. And so all I can say safely, Ethan, is that whenever I watched it, I was too young to watch it the first time, and enjoyed it in for what it was. But I would echo what Brad said. As I rewatched it this time, I am both amazed at how good it is and like, well, why don't I watch this more? And then it's like, well, because this isn't particularly a pleasant movie to watch, even as it is extremely well done.
My first experience with this, I can't, you know, nail down an exact time. It was high school. It was around the same time. So, I mean, I guess if I was going to guess, it'd be, you know, 2008 to 2010 when I was really becoming like a full blown movie nerd. I was a big Brad Pitt fan still. You know, I had already seen Fight Club, things like that. Oh, this is the same guy that directed Fight Club. I should watch this. Had the old, I don't know if you guys remember the way DVD boxes used to be. It was like the clip on the one side and like the fold out like paper opening, and it had all the scenes listed on it. So like, I just remember the box. I remember the poster. It's just one of those that always be like burned into my mind. And watched it with my stepbrother, and one of the wildest first viewing experiences, because even being, you know, 10 to 15 years late to the party, had no part of this movie ruined for me. Had no idea what was going to happen right up until the end. And I'm so glad. Like, to anyone who saw this for the first time and had it ruined for them, I apologize. I'm so sorry that you didn't get to experience this the correct way, because there's one way to see this movie and it's like that. And then on the rewatch too, I understand what you guys are saying. It's kind of in the same vein as like Prisoners, right? That we've already done on this show. Man, it's great, but how do you just sit around and go, yeah, let's fire this up. Let's have a fun Saturday night. But I tell you what, every time, I mean, I don't want to get too much into it, but every time I start this and it's the cold open with Morgan Freeman and then that title track, it's the creepiest thing, but it locks me right in and I'm ready to go for this 2-hour journey every single time. So I never regret hitting play. It just sometimes it takes a lot for me to actually watch it. I don't know how many times I've seen it. It's not Red Eye territory, Brad. Don't worry. I don't need any extra therapy. I may need some because of Don Johnson's asshole, but not for this movie. Let's play the Rotten Tomatoes game. This week it's me versus Mike. The red bearded bros going at it here one-on-one. Mike trying to get back on his throne of this game. It's been bouncing around a lot recently, so I have to go first. I have to guess what the Rotten Tomatoes score of 7 is, and then he gets the chance to snipe me one way or the other. I mean, this has got to be pretty high, right? Like, this is just kind of one of those movies. As long as it's been around, the legacy that it has, you know, it's a 90-something. I just have to, which side do I want to leave Mike on? Because of how insanely creepy it is, I don't think it crosses that 95 threshold. I don't think it's going to end up being, you know, the top we've ever done with like Good Will Hunting and the one other, I think. I'm going to go 92 and I'm going to make Mike decide, is it the low 90s or does it kiss that 95?
Well, you actually made this pretty easy for me because I don't think that it's going to be as high as you did. So I'm going to take the under on that and I'll do a 91. The number I had in my head and would have gone with if I was leading off was an 85. Simply because of some of the reasons we talked about for rewatchability. As good as it is, it's dark enough. So I'll go 91 and we'll see if I'm destined to be called a cheater again. Brad?
Well, if we were playing audience score, Ethan, you would have won. But because we play critics score, Mike has once again won as it comes in at 82%.
Wow. That's a little bit audience lower than I even thought.
Audience is 95.
All right. So now, I mean, the next question I ask, like always, is Rotten Tomatoes correct? And my initial reaction, I've got to say, and I love Tin Cup. I'm reaching back into last week. I think this is more egregious than last week's. Brad, I know you had a big problem with where the critics had that versus our opinion of it. I get that it's dark. I get that it's hard to watch. I understand it. But to say that this is not one of the beginning to end, I don't know where you guys are going to rank it at. I haven't even ranked it yet. This is one of the best movies we've done on this show. Is it rewatchable? Can you sit and fire it up every week? No. Acting performances, storytelling, thrills, tension, ending, all of it. This is one of the best movies we've done on this show. I'll get that out of the way now when I ask you guys the question. But Rotten Tomatoes is way wrong.
So I guess my inclination is that it probably, I said I was thinking 85 is where I was going to go with this, but I think that probably an average, if you took the critic score and the fan score, is probably closer where I'd put it. It's not going to rank as high for me as it probably will for you, but that's because as I do my rankings, I do factor rewatchability fairly heavily into it. But I do agree with you that in terms of the films that we've watched just based on quality, this is pretty high up there. And in particular, because of the acting performances that we're going to get into. We've talked about it before. I'm sure we're going to talk about it again today. I think the more that I see Brad Pitt, the more I think he might at this point be criminally underrated as an actor. You know, consider, which is crazy considering how popular he is and how well known he is. But I think that the critics are wrong. I don't think that they're like egregiously wrong, but there's also not as much room between where they put this as an 82 and where you were thinking it was as a 95 as there was maybe with, you know, Brad last week with Tin Cup at a 72 and thinking that that should have been in the 90s. So I would have felt good with upper 80s, low 90s if that's where this landed. And I think that's probably where it should have landed.
I think that both numbers, critic and audience, even though they're so far apart, I'm going to say they're both right. Because as a fan, I think I would rate this in the low to mid 90s. I really do. I think as someone who now has watched and is starting to learn how to pick apart movies and see some of the the good and the bad of what movies are. I think an 82 is pretty fair from a critic standpoint, because much like what I was praising Tin Cup for, I think Seven also hits on what it tried to be. It is. There hasn't been much like it. And the ones that have attempted to be like it have come up short, but there are also a lot of, holes, I guess I would say. I don't think they did a good enough job of making you care about Gwyneth Paltrow, and her death. Rewatching it this time, I felt bad for Brad Pitt, but I wasn't there with her on the, oh my gosh, I'm so heartbroken that she's dead sort of way that they could have. I think that they could have done a lot more with Kevin Spacey's character. I think there was some stuff left off of that, because you went from like no clue what's going on to they find this, you know, library card, and now all of a sudden the guy's turning himself in. And it just kind of felt like it jumped from we're going nowhere and finding nothing to, oh, now we've got all the answers and it's going to play itself out really quickly. I had some problems with, I didn't realize how much they kind of telegraphed, the ending throughout this. When I was watching it this time, you kind of see it coming, especially when after that conversation between her and Morgan Freeman in the restaurant, you know that something is going to happen. That was, I think, their attempt to kind of like make her personable. And then I also, I don't know, I didn't like the rain in every scene. I don't know why that bothered me a little bit. It wasn't necessary for some of it. And also, like, do no buildings have power? I don't get why everything is just so dark for no reason other than being dark. But those are just a few nitpicky things. I really enjoy this film. I have it, I believe it's falling in at number 21 on our list. Actually 20, so top 20. That's good for the number that we've seen. I'm not, as a fan, like I said, I would rate it much higher, but I don't think the critic score is criminally low like Ethan does. So I'm be excited to hear, I guess, why you think it's so criminally low.
Well, so let's touch on Gwyneth Paltrow, because I don't disagree with you that she's not made out to be a necessarily likable character. She's only in a couple scenes in this movie. But I think what I noticed this time, what I looked at, what I think actually makes it even more tragic is the effort that they put in. If you listen to the things that Brad Pitt says and you look at the way they interact with each other, I'm actually completely convinced that these two people would end up getting a divorce. These two people would not have lived a happy life had she survived. I think what makes it tragic is that she clearly knows that and he clearly doesn't. And I think that's what makes it worse, is that she is the only bit of humanity that he's holding on to. I think all of the things he says, all of the beliefs that he has, the conversation that him and Morgan Freeman have in the bar about, yes, I do care about people, I will care about people, I think that's him trying to impress her. That's him trying to live up to his high school sweetheart and be what she thought he was 10 years ago, however old they're supposed to be in this movie. Whereas her view of their relationship is to call up a guy she's known for 3 days and ask him if she should get an abortion or not. Like, she clearly is not, there's something missing in their relationship that she knows about and she sees, and Brad Pitt doesn't. And in 30 seconds of screen time, when that box gets delivered, all of a sudden the guy that was feigning belief in the world, or maybe had a little bit of belief in the world, is just ripped in half. And he does it with like two looks of his face, looking down and looking up. And like, I've always thought that scene is amazing, but I never focused in on their relationship as much as I had this time. And that's what it felt like to me, was it's even more tragic because she's not really having it and he's just blind to it because, like, this is all he's ever known and that's all he's ever wanted. And so that's what I think makes it more tragic, even if she's not necessarily likable, which I agree with.
I think you guys are raising some good points here. And, you know, some of your nitpicks, Brad, I would say I tend to agree with in terms of why it's not as rewatchable for me, like even down to the rain and the darkness. But I also think that thematically, that's what makes it work so well. And what I had to do is really remind myself, to your point, Ethan, what it was like the first time I watched this. And I agree with you. If you know what you're looking for, they telegraph it. But man, the gut punch that I still recall from the first time I watched this, when you realize what's in the box, telegraphed or not, I think it's powerful, but I don't think it's as obvious the first time you watch it through as it is. It's one of those movies. Once you have the hook, right, you can't unsee the hook. And so then you start to make sense of everything in hindsight. I think that it plays well, but I think, again, all of the stuff you're talking about with the relationship or the lack thereof, the development of it, the lack thereof, in a movie that is set so tonally in a dark, grungy, every day is raining, the coldness of their relationship and the lack of communication, I think, plays in with the motif that you're getting from this movie. Because you really kind of have those two plot lines running side by side, right? You have the serial killer with the seven deadly sins, and that's you know, if you will, it's your A storyline, and then your B storyline is just this world that they're inhabiting, which doesn't have sunshine, which doesn't have light, which is raining all the time, which has distant relationships that aren't real, genuine, but have to be because that's what's expected. And I think that's the world that Morgan Freeman's character in particular is trying to get out of, but has inhabited for so long.
Yeah, I think part of the problem I have with this a little bit with the Gwyneth Paltrow thing is they spent so little time developing that character that she's almost, to me, below a couple of the characters that were dead as far as how much screen time they get and how much you see and understand the situation. Like, it was so little and so... I guess for a character that's going to die and is supposed to have such a impact on how you feel about this movie, you know, they spent more time in a couple of those scenes examining bodies and spending more time with those dead people, specifically the guy that gorged himself to death, to where, like, that dead person almost had as much screen time as her. And I don't know what the decision that went into that was. But why not play out a little bit more on some of that? I think they spent a lot more time in those rooms with those dead bodies than what were necessary, because in reality, like, they aren't CSI and they honestly really didn't figure out a whole lot from them other than the fact that they were chasing somebody who was into the seven deadly sins, which was pretty apparent pretty quickly, you know, as far as, like, you know, he spelled out some of the words once they found that note behind the refrigerator written in Greece. Like, it really didn't need to spend a lot more time with the dead bodies and the crime scenes. And that's where they could have taken that time to develop some of the interplay between Pitt and Paltrow. Or to your point, Ethan, if you're correct that they were going to possibly end in a divorce, like, why not get it to that point in the movie? And then you see the redemption and you see the relationship, you know, coming back. And then she tells him if she would have told him she was pregnant, and you see them, okay, we're going to build this and it's going to be a thing and life is good. Once we finish this, I'll talk to you about moving out of the city and, you know, something like that. And then she dies. And then all of that future that you hope to see gets ripped away. Because if you're right, if they weren't going to be together anyway, obviously we don't want her to die, but that makes it less dramatic if for him she wasn't going to be in his life anyway. You know, I think the part that hurt at the end was that he found out she was pregnant, you know.
Right. And that's why, I mean, I wouldn't trade any conversation they could have in a million years for watching Brad Pitt. I rewound the scene and watched it twice when I watched it here tonight before we recorded, because that, I don't think he has, and I don't think he ever will have a better moment in his career acting than that 3 minutes with him finding out what's going on. And when,
but
he
don't
says,
you think you would have seen that though, if he no. knew she was pregnant and then got killed, and then he's like, wait, you just killed her and you killed my baby and you killed my future because we were going to live happily ever after. Like, we still would have had that.
I think it's because this is lit. This is the way this plays out. We get to watch him basically convince. He knows when he's yelling, throw your gun away and don't listen, don't listen. He's already coming up. You can see the gears turning. What's the worst thing? Why would he be telling? Oh my, no. No, and he's like, please tell me she's okay. And he won't lie to him. And so we see that. Then we see him accept, okay, my wife's head is in that box. She is dead. What choice am I going to make? Then he says, and the life of her baby. And we watch it somehow get worse. Like, if he knew all that stuff, it would just be in one shot. It would probably be still be very emotional. But the layers that he goes through, I wouldn't trade that for anything. Watching Brad Pitt be... I mean, one of the best 3 minute performances I've ever seen. And I think it goes back. All of this goes back to Mike. I want to hear your thoughts on this too, but all of the way they wrote this, it's all putting trust in those three guys. If the three guys in the scene weren't good actors, I would be agreeing with you. Right. Because it is not a lot of development for a very important thing, but the choice they made was this movie is going to be focused on the killings and these detectives and a little bit on this person that's important in a sense, but it's got to all fall on the three of them. Because if the three of those guys don't go bang, bang, bang and turn in an insane performance, you're right. It doesn't hit home and it's not impactful. But they do, and it ends up being what I think one of the greatest final scenes in any movie ever.
Yeah, and I don't often, like, totally disagree. I got to say, I think that if they had laid it out the way you describe, Brad, it makes the movie not just not better. I think it makes it worse, because I think that the lack of interplay, when you couple it with Spacey, you know, revealing himself as Envy, and he's envying this relationship that you're sitting there going, like, well, why are you envying this? I don't understand why this guy would even be necessarily that bent out of shape. And then you see what Pitt maybe saw the relationship as, but you don't have the background for it. As Ethan pointed out, you've got the context of her reaching out to this guy she barely knows to have the conversation about, should I keep the child or not? I'm pregnant with this kid, and I'm not sure that I can raise the kid in the city and all of that. I think that the darkness of this movie, thematically, in the scenes, in terms of the content, all of it is about some of the fallacies of relationships. It's a dark take, a dark view on humanity, on society. But, you know, we're sitting here talking about their relationship and how it didn't feel warm enough. It didn't feel genuine enough. He didn't see the happy ever after. And yet that's what the killer was envying, because that's how cold and calloused and outcast his life had been. That this relationship, that from what we can tell, it's not like it was this like madly in love relationship, was so good that he envied that and therefore used that as the setup for the completion of the seven deadly sins killing. And so I think, you know, even as I was listening to you guys talking, I think this movie actually just moved up a few slots in my rankings, because I think it shied away from taking the easy way out, which would have been to spend more screen time with the two of them, develop that relationship and make you, you know, have that gut punch from how you feel about them. Instead, you don't really feel much of anything about them, but you sure as heck, like you said, Ethan, see it all over Pitt's face, which makes it that much more impactful.
So I know we're spending a lot of time on this, but I think it's important, because I don't think that either side is right or wrong. I think for me, I'm just looking at it differently. I felt like I wanted more when that delivery driver pulls up with that box. And even though obviously I knew what was in there, I didn't feel as sorry for her as I did for him. And that's really weird in that setting because she's the one that lost her life. And I guess I wish that there was something that the director could have done better to make me feel more sad for her. I'm not arguing at all about the final scene. I think that I probably would have played that differently. Acting that out if I were him, for how I would feel if I were in the exact same situation. But also every situation is different, you know, like I don't know that I would have even hesitated on the shooting. I talked about this with a couple people that I watched it with. I would have rather beat the guy senseless and let him live. And basically live as a vegetable for that, because it kind of lets you keep your humanity as a cop, but also shows the side of a husband and a father, and just, you know, somehow made that the therapy that I needed to get through that. But I guess I don't want to take anything away from that scene that you guys are talking about. And if you think that's what it would do, then I'll agree that maybe they did it the right way. I just wish they also then could have figured out a way to make me care more about her and her death than what they did. And I think that's where, to me, this movie misses and spends a little bit too much time on some things that are less important than why should I care that there's a human head in this box. Obviously, you know, the humanity side of it, but as a movie watcher, why should I care about this? You know, and I think that other movies have done a better job of that, but not other movies have done a better job of putting the whole package together like Seven has.
Yeah, it's obviously it's fair criticism. The movie's not 100% for fans and critics. Like, people have problems with this movie. Mike, did you have something to add to it?
Was just going to say, yeah, just in closing, you know, you're saying, Brad, you wish that they'd done something to make you care about her more and her losing her life more. But, you probably didn't have any more or less care about the other prior victims, right? And I think that's kind of the point, is she's slightly got more of a role in here, but really, again, this is not a movie about her relationship with him as much as it is society in general. And she was just another means to his end. And so I guess, yeah, I think it's an interesting point, and I'll have to chew on all of that, because, you know, the next time I rewatch this, which it will happen again, I enjoy this movie enough, I'll watch it again. I'll probably be thinking about it more through the context of their relationship.
I think it.
Sorry, I was one more point. Sorry that I was thinking. Actually, go ahead and make yours, because I want to hash this out a little bit more before I say it.
I was going to shift gears. I was going to start talking about the director and some other stuff. So if you want to,
I was going to say, like, another interesting choice of trying to make us care or not care about this person is to have her openly talk about abortion for a reason none other than I'm unhappy that we live in the city. Do I want to raise my child in this city? Like, there are plenty of options to have that child have a nice, safe place to live other than having an abortion. So I guess maybe that's on the, you know, moral side for me of why I care a little bit less about her, is like, why she's wanting to, you know, potentially take this child's life simply because of an unhappy location or an unhappy marriage or whatever. It just seemed like a very thin reason to have an abortion. And I'm not 100% anti-abortion, because I feel like there are some scenarios or situations where it is plausible, or, you know, for health reasons might be okay, but I'm definitely far enough against it to where her reasons or her justifications for it are a complete no-no to me. So that was just another interesting choice of hook or the catalyst for the director to try to introduce and get you to care about that character a little bit more. So, I mean, we don't have to go super deep into that, cause I know we're kind of walking a fine line of, offending some people and things like that. But, yeah, just for me, that kind of stood out there as, an interesting choice.
I think it's interesting. They never say what city they're in or where they're from or where they came from. So I think it's really interesting. And like you guys have mentioned, the rain and the darkness and stuff like that. I do think that the setting itself.
I think it said Los Angeles, which is also interesting for the rain. They don't say it, but I saw it written.
Okay.
That it was California.
They filmed a lot in California and Los Angeles, okay. But everything I read specifically said it was an unnamed big city.
Okay. So then my point being that since they don't just openly say like, this is where we are, I think that they want it to be that the city represents how they each see the world. Because there's a lot, I mean, it comes down to the final line, right? Like, the world is a beautiful place and it's worth fighting for. I agree with the second part. And, you know, it's not raining at the end. Like, I think there is a lot to say. I think they did put a lot of thought into the setting. Yes, she does see that city as this place. And Brad, I completely agree with everything you're saying, but I think her view of it has just become so, disenchanted, I guess, that is just the only world she can see anymore, is this dark, rainy, nasty, it's just beating these people into this existence. I want to talk David Fincher. We've talked about him before with Fight Club. I think he's a fantastic director. I'm a huge fan. I think, to give credit, something that's interesting, a choice that he made. I think the best choice he made in this movie, two choices. It happens in the final scene, and it happens a little bit before it. We've talked about this before, how like the human imagination is always going to be worse than the reality. I think what takes this movie from kind of like uncomfortable into like, oh dear God, is the lust victim and the head in the box. And the crazy thing is, we don't see either one of them. And I was curious what you guys thought about that choice, because when I thought back on it, like, I thought that was just a genius decision, because the two most horrifying things in this movie we don't see, and yet they're the ones that disturb me the most. The lust killing. I mean, when I think about that scene, I'm like, oh God, it's disgusting. It's you don't see anything. You see a picture of what they use. But I think that's a genius move. I think setting the tone, building the world, I think he did a great job. I'm a huge fan. So if you guys have any thoughts on that, and then just kind of just David Fincher in general. I don't know if you guys are a fan, but I am a massive fan of Fincher.
Well, I guess I have a question before we get into that. Is, you said the two most horrifying things that we see in this movie, we don't actually see, but why are they more horrifying than the other deaths? What is it about those that is the only thing that stands out as different? Is those are the two female victims. I don't know how much that plays into your morality of the situation, but why are those more horrifying than seeing fat guys explode, or the guy in the bed that was made to, you know, over the course of a year to get to that point? Like, what makes those more horrifying?
Because of the imagination. Because, yeah, I mean, obviously the fat guy sitting there, that's disgusting. But you see it, and you move on. The sloth guy is creepy. The girl who gets her nose cut off is, you know, what. But the idea, because they see the picture, right? They see the Polaroid of the thing. And he's like, good God, you made this for someone? So, like, they're already in the middle of this world. They're more horrified than they've been. Like, are you freaking kidding me? You built this thing? And then the reaction of the guy when they're interrogating him, And then with the head in the box thing, it's as he's describing it to Brad Pitt. I mean, you can't help but there's an image in your head. Like, what did he do? Did he knock her out? Did he saw it off? Like, I think it's a very great choice to leave that up to the imagination. And that to me makes it even more horrifying than the dead remains of the fat guy in the spaghetti. My opinion. I just think that's a great choice that they made.
Okay.
And I'll tell you, it would have taken me out of the final scene if when he opens that box, the camera pans down and you see someone's head in it. I think that would have broken my concentration on that scene from what's more important in.
What if you would have just seen blonde hair?
That would have been okay. I mean, that would have been okay. But just like some prosthetic head in a box, I think would have been too far.
Sorry, so I know I asked you the question of that, but what was your original question that you wanted us to ponder?
Just what you guys thought about that, just if you were in line with that did work.
Yeah, the imagination?
I just think that choice really stood out to me this time when I watched it.
Yeah, I'm glad they didn't show the head in the box. And obviously a knife penis slicing up a woman, you know, like I don't know how you would fit that into a movie and make it so anyone could watch it. So I'm glad that they left those two things out. I like the choice to not show the head because I think the imagination does enough there, and I understand the reasoning for not showing the killing. But other than Envy, I guess correct me if I'm wrong, but we don't see any of the other every murders already happened, right? Other than Brad Pitt shooting him. So in some ways, each murder has something left to the imagination. They just, you know, show different levels of grotesqueness, I guess. Also, I don't know, maybe I'm just way off here, but did it get less and less revealing with each murder? To the one you don't even see the head in the box, and then after you don't see the head in the box, you actually see a physical murder. So it's almost like he started big, smaller, 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 till you don't see it, and then you actually see what happened. So I don't know if that's coincidental or if that's
actually a really good point. Because I mean, I guess I was just focused on what you don't see at all. But they really, outside of Sloth, I mean, even the fat guy, it's in a very dark room. The Sloth one is out there, and of course, because they're trying to get the jump scare of when he sits up. But really, it is a lot of it is description. I don't think we ever see the body of Greed, except in pictures afterwards. You see him standing there with the blood left over, Pitt, but you don't see much of that one either. So I guess it is a lot. I think they
take each one down just a little bit for how much it reveals, and that could just be coincidence, but. But maybe not as well. So, I'll stand behind his choice. One choice, I guess, because we probably won't talk about it specifically, but one part that bothered me is why he opened fire on those two officers standing in the hallway. He saw them well before they saw him. He paused, he stood there. Then because he stood there, they were like, hey, check it out. Like, if he sees those two cops standing by his door, why doesn't he just turn around and go back down the stairs? Like, what's
caught
him
off guard? Like, he is so confident and full of himself that this is the greatest plan ever. He never expected to walk in on two cops. And when he did.
Right. But then stand there and then pull out a gun, you know, like.
Because it led to a great freaking scene, Brad. That's why.
I mean, even if he had just taken off running, it still would have led to that same scene, you know, like it just doesn't make sense for his character, as controlled as he is and as methodical and, you know, patient and all of those things, to just pull out a gun and open fire there. It really bothered me because it was so out of character for him.
Let's talk some characters real quick here. I mean, there's three to really talk about. Brad Pitt. Mike, you mentioned that you think more and more he's underrated overall. I mean, you guys know how much I love Fight Club. It's my favorite movie of all time. He's such a caricature in that. It's hard for me to say that this could be his best performance. It's so different from Moneyball. Fight Club is obviously so special to me, but he gets the opportunity to just be the guy that everybody, you know, loves and remembers from the movie. He's freaking wild, his hair on fire for 2 hours. And maybe I'm just leaning into that final scene, but it's at least up there, right? Like, this is at least like the Mount Rushmore of Brad Pitt performances, even if it is just that final scene. And I don't think it is, because I think he gives a good performance all the way through. But where are you guys at on Brad Pitt? And Mike, like I said, I already know you said you're starting to think he might be underrated.
So I think he, I don't know if you can call him underrated. I understand where Mike's coming from, but I think he's closer to being arguably the greatest movie star of our generation than he is to being underrated. Like, I think if you ask most people to name their top five or 10, the top five or 10 best actors in the world, like, a lot of people are going to include him on that list. So hard to say underrated, unless you're making the argument that if he's anything lower than five, it's a catastrophe, because he deserves to be up there with, you know, in the top two or three of everybody's list. I tell you, like, I just watched the movie The Lost City a couple nights ago. Oh, and
yes,
like, even his small role in that, like, he's in so few scenes, but he steals the movie. It's such a great cameo performance that the things that I left that movie, and I really enjoyed it, the things that I left, like, I was quoting things that he said or things that involved him, you know, and it's just, yeah, very entertaining. So to me, he's up there, and he's definitely in my top five of biggest movie stars of my lifetime. So I don't feel that he's underrated, but I definitely see where Mike's coming from, that maybe underappreciated is maybe a better way to put that. But yeah, I don't know. I guess be interested to hear what Mike says about that.
Yeah, and I think that's actually kind of my point, is that you said that you would have him as maybe the best actor of the generation. And I don't think that that's immediately where people would go with him. I think that people would go more that he, you know, had some good films, but he wasn't really that great of an actor. Maybe he was just, you know, a good looking guy back then, you know, when he was in his prime. And so he got a lot of parts because of that. But I do think there's probably an argument that he is the best actor of the generation. And, you know, a lot of it's going to be dependent on what he does in the final kind of third of his career, if you will. And if he has a couple of movies, or even just one major one, that garners him an Academy Award victory, where he's able to use some of the acting chops he has and knock it out of the park, I think that that may move him back towards more properly rated. But as it is right now, I think that in the general public, he is probably closer to an afterthought than he should be, given his filmography and the variety of roles that he plays. I mean, he does this movie the same year that he does 12 Monkeys, right? And I think he got nominated for that one, if I'm not mistaken, for an Academy Award. And then you've also got movies like the Ocean's movies, which are a very different character, but does that very well. Fight Club, certainly. And I just think he's really, again, I think you put it well, Brad, he is in that discussion for best actor of the generation, or he should be. I just don't think that he's in that discussion as much as we might think.
I would label him in my lifetime the best blend of talent and charisma, you know, and the underrated side of it is people don't appreciate the talent enough. I think when you say to people that statement, you could get them to like, oh, yeah, I guess. But he's got one Academy Award in his entire career, and it's for Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, which he's great in. But comparatively, he's been overlooked. Maybe because he's charismatic, and sometimes the Academy has a bunch of sticks up their asses. Morgan Freeman, we haven't talked about a ton. Morgan Freeman's the guy that's like, yeah, man, he's an all-timer. He's a Hall of Famer. But I don't just say that I love Morgan Freeman. I think he's fantastic in this. But I've never just been like, oh, my God, yes. So I don't know if you guys have any thoughts on him. Look, there's Kevin Spacey. We've had this conversation before on here. It's hard to avoid when we do movies from this era that are well-made movies because he was in a lot of them. We make the jokes about perfect casting and stuff like this, but I mean, I'll say it, guys, like, and you guys will both go Usual Suspects, but I think pound for pound, time on screen, this is the best 20 minutes of Kevin Spacey's career. Like, I mean, from the moment he walks in and screams detective, and I'll never, right back to the first, my heart still drops. Just the way he does it is so creepy, and he's dripping in blood. And then the conversation he has in the car all the way up to the end, I think it's the best 20 minutes of acting he's ever done. I think it's a masterclass in acting. He's a terrible guy. I never want to meet him. I don't think he should ever work again. But he was really, really good for a really long time, and I think this might be the peak.
I mean, for me, it's Usual Suspects, but I definitely understand where you're coming from.
Well, and again, with a similar reprise, that Usual Suspects was this year as well, correct?
It was.
I think.
Yeah, or the next. Somewhere.
Look it up. And so, yeah, you look at that, and again, a couple of same year.
Which is probably why he didn't get nominated for this. Yeah, sometimes they do double nominate, but yeah.
Well, yeah, everything you said, I'll just circle back to Morgan Freeman, because I agree with everything that you said about Spacey, and whether it's this or Usual Suspects, it's one of the two, and two incredible performances in the same year. But when we are talking about Morgan Freeman, again, just I tend to always enjoy him in everything he's in. I'm always happy to see him there. I think he does a good job. I think he was stellar playing for, I mean, this wasn't a comedy, but in terms of the way that they played, right? The straight man to Brad Pitt's character. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, I think they played off of each other very well. And with all three of them, as you mentioned, that final scene doesn't work if even one of the three of them does not deliver an all-time performance. And what you end up with is three iconic actors at the top of their game, all bringing it 100%. And so that final scene is really, you know, is that the best movie? It's not the one I'll remember Freeman for. I think that's undoubtedly Shawshank Redemption. It's probably not the one that I'll remember Spacey for. That's probably, you know, Usual Suspects. It probably is the scene I remember Brad Pitt for the most, but what makes it special is all three of them together.
Agreed. So asking you guys what the best scene is feels, you know, wrong. Because we talked for a half hour about one scene. If I'm wrong on that, stop me. But do we just want to mention any lines that stuck out to us?
That interaction where he's using his words in the car on the way over there, and he, you know, just gets under Brad Pitt's skin. Like, it's just masterclass in manipulation, and very interesting dialogue there. There isn't a particular part of it that stood out, but it was just really cool to see how he used his words to set up that whole final scene. Cause without that car ride over there and the way he angered him, there is a chance that Brad Pitt doesn't pull that trigger, you know, like all of that layer on layer with the murder and all of that stuff, like really played into it. So I think that interaction in the car driving out there was really, really good.
Yeah, I agree. I don't know that I necessarily have a favorite line from this, but the favorite scene probably has to be the car ride out. And if I were to dig into the script to find a favorite line, I suspect that it would come somewhere from that scene.
Yeah, I mean, that's fantastic. It's tough not to pick that. I do. There's a lot of things that Morgan Freeman says in this that really stuck out to me this time. And I, you know, I realized it really is his movie, right? Like, this movie is the retirement story of this guy. Like, he opens it and he closes it. And I mentioned the final line. I think it's just really heartbreaking. But also, you know, like, this is what it took for this guy to have a little faith in the world at the end of it. Yet, you know, why would you have faith in the world after seeing this? But somehow he found it. And I think the conversation they have at the bar, I thought was really, really good. Him talking about apathy and, you know, it's easier to take drugs than deal with life. It's easier to beat a child than raise it. Love costs. You know, that whole thing I thought was really, really well done. So just a lot of the stuff they say, and like you guys already mentioned, that stuff in the car. I think that'll just about do it, guys. It will wrap up our conversation of Seven. We hope you guys enjoyed that, enjoyed the rewatch, as uncomfortable as the movie may be. Next week, we're going to go back into the sports realm in a way that we never have before. You know, we've done golf, we've done baseball on the show. We're going to do racing, Formula One racing next week on the show. Ron Howard directing Chris Hemsworth in the movie Rush. And I think neither of you guys have seen it, correct?
I have not.
So a first viewing for Mike and Brad. I'll be on the hot seat because I'm bringing this to them. I'm a big fan of it. We hope you guys will end up being a fan of it as well. Other than that, guys, for Mike, for Brad, I'm Ethan. We'll see you next time.